So we'll now call upon Brother Jim to give his third and final class for this afternoon, the challenge of remaining steadfast to the end. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you again, Brother Derek. Well, brothers and sisters and young people and friends, we've come back to have a look just at one ecclesia in this session, which is probably a good thing. However, you notice that this letter to the Thyatirans was actually a little bit longer than some of the others. And so there's a very important matter in here that we're going to discover in our consideration. We're going to go back and have a look at the roots, why the Lord uses Jezebel and why he says certain things here in this letter. They are deep in the Old Testament, as we shall see. Well, Thyatira, it was the least notable city of all the seven that were to receive a letter from our Lord. Historians record not much at all of it in the 200 years before AD 96. So it's quite obscure in many ways. It was fortified by the Greeks as a military fortress because it stood in the Lycus Valley, and of course armies normally would go through valleys, which this valley ran north and south, joining the Hermus and the Caicus valleys. And so it was there as a fortress. Losing its military significance over time, during the Roman times in particular, it became a large and prosperous commercial centre. It was 80 kilometres or 50 miles east of Pergamos. It was that royal city's outpost, you might say, its guard post, to slow down invaders who were coming from the east. It was noted for its trade guilds or its unions. For example, there was the Guild of the Dyers. Quite significant, of course, because we know a woman who became a sister in Christ who was from this city, don't we? And she used to deal in dyed garments. So every skilled worker was a member of a union and was expected to support his association. Sounds a bit like the modern world in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, and maybe even 80s. The truth was started here by the work of Lydia. She was converted by the Apostle Paul, of course, in Philippi in the record of Acts chapter 16, and at verse 14 we read about her. And Paul would have continued that work. He would have built up that ecclesia while he was at Ephesus, and he would have made journeys up those valleys and visited certain of these meetings and done his best. And if it wasn't Paul, it would have been ambassadors sent by Paul who would have gone to promote the growth and development of those ecclesias. Acts 19, verses 8 to 10 tells us about that period of time. So if you go to Thyatira today, this is what you find. The ruins of the ancient city, long since gone, as is the ecclesia, long since gone. There is no ecclesia in our directories called Thyatira. You cannot look up a list of the names of brethren and sisters. That hasn't been the case for a long, long time. What went wrong? Well, it's suggested by the opening gambit of this letter. Have a look with me at the record here that begins in verse 18. And unto the angel, the arranging body of the ecclesia in Thyatira, write, these things saith the Son of God. That's a lofty title. The Son of God, who hath his eyes like unto a flame of fire, and his feet are like fine brass. So why does the Lord draw from the vision of the multitudinous Christ the eyes like a flame of fire? Well, the eye is a symbol of intelligence, isn't it? And you know, you can see anger in people's eyes at times, can't you? As I said the other night here, my children used to say to me, when they were a little older, they said, Dad, when you used to look at us, and we were in trouble, your eyes, they were like flames. Well, of course, sometimes they were. So you can see anger in people's eyes. And in the multitudinous Christ, the eyes are like a flame of fire. This is about divine judgment, the anger of divine judgment. And that judgment is going to fall upon the Jezebel class and those who don't deal with them. So that's why you've got that. What about the feet? like fine brass. Well, this comes, of course, from the earlier vision as well. That was the defeat of the multitudinous Christ. Brass or bronze is the symbol of purified man, isn't it? So we've got this burnished brass. It's a symbol for the immortal judge who called himself the Son of Man. John 5:27, God has given into my hands, he says, all judgment because I am the Son of Man. He knew all about human nature. He knew all about human problems. But also, that's a title about exercising dominion in the earth. Because he did what the first Adam didn't do. The last Adam restored the dominion that was lost by the first Adam. And he's coming as the judge. So here, he's using the language of judgment. Because this ecclesia was facing disaster. And he's warning them, you don't get your act together, watch out. I'm coming as a judge. So the letter arrives on the first day of the week. And the recorder gets up to read this one in Thyatira. So what's it like? Well, he's introduced himself, and then he says, I know thy works. And there's something quite interesting about the way that verse 19 unfolds. He says, I know thy works, and thy love, and service, and faith, and thy patience, your endurance under trial, and thy works. Hang on, I thought he mentioned that before. So works is mentioned twice. And it's a clue, brethren and sisters. It's an important clue. I'll tell you a trend that I am noticing in our brotherhood in the last 15 or 20 years or so. You know, where I come from, we've sort of just copied the world in a number of ways. You know, we're doing what the churches do. To a certain extent, we have... I'm not saying that these things are wrong. We have Christadelphian schools. They're really good in many ways. There's also another side to that coin. Because in Australia, you get government funding for your schools. We have old people's rest homes. My mother was in there for two decades. So they're good. Problem is that you get government funding in Australia for them. And the government says, you've got to do certain things. You know, we're going to give you money. You've got to do certain things. So you put yourself in a position where maybe pressure's going to come on to do things that maybe you wouldn't do if there wasn't government funding. That's one thing that's happening. So in a way that we're sort of copying what the churches have done. And we're also becoming a little bit more like, I don't know whether you have the Salvation Army in this country, do you? You're the people who go around and, you know, find the drug addicts in the street. And I mean, they do a fantastic work in terms of helping people who are in great need. But where does it lead? Where is it going? Is it going to lead to eternal life for those people? It might ease their burden today and maybe even tomorrow. But does it lead anywhere for them? They don't teach any doctrine, do they, the Salvation Army? No. So they're do-gooders, and that follows, they think, the Christ model. You know, you've got to do good. Yeah, that's true. But it doesn't go anywhere. And I think there's a trend in our community towards works. You know, works, doing things for people. Some of it's not going anywhere. That's my assessment. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to lead to people necessarily receiving the real blessing, which will be eternal life. And I think that's the trend, and it was here in Thyatira. Oh, yes, they had works, and they decided that they needed more works. So they went and they redoubled their works. But they had a problem. Their attention was taken away from a class in the meeting who were teaching the doctrines of Jezebel. And that was going to destroy the ecclesia. And it's not there today, so it did. So we've got to be very, very careful. We're getting our balance right. We've got to see it from a divine perspective, not from a human perspective. And that's the problem of the latter days, isn't it? Everything's seen from a human perspective. Humanism is dominating the world. It's going to bring the world to Armageddon. We've got to be careful. We see it from a divine perspective. So how would you summarise this letter? He only raises one problem, but it's a serious one. He says, I have against thee. You know, I dropped out some words here. You look at that verse verse 20 in the Authorized Translation, it says, "Notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee." The phrase "a few things" is not in the text. He's only got one thing against them: the toleration of the Jezebel class. That's what he's got against them. Just one problem. So how are we going to summarize this? Even when the faithful know and do many right things, many works, an ecclesia can be endangered by false teachers. We must steadfastly hold fast to the faith once delivered to the saints. We must not let it go, as Thyatira ultimately did. So let's have our summary. Thyatira was the compromising ecclesia. They were commended by Christ for works, love, and service, faith, and endurance, and more works. Focus on doing, but not on doctrine. But they were criticized for toleration of a seducing Jezebel class. And only one thing is imposed upon them by Christ, and that's spelled out in verse 24. In verse 24 he says this, "But unto you I say, and unto the rest in Thyatira, as many as have not this doctrine." So he's talking to the people who haven't yet been corrupted by it, and which have not known the depths of Satan as they speak, "I will put upon you none other burden." Well, he doesn't actually tell them what the burden is, does he? He doesn't actually spell it out. But it's pretty plain what it is. Deal with the Jezebel class before you become corrupted. That's what he's saying. Deal with it. And you see, the problem with dealing with this is that they talk. They talk in a way that's seductive, like Jezebel did. Have a look at what it says here in verse 24. "They have not known the depths of Satan as they speak." Yes, you know, error is always clothed, isn't it, in disguise, the disguise of profundity. It always sounds very profound. You know, that's how it comes over, isn't it? And that's why it's seductive. That's why it appeals to the simple and those who are not biblically knowledgeable. It appeals to them because it sounds profound, the depths of Satan as they speak. So he lays upon them the burden of dealing with the problem of the Jezebel class in their meeting. What was she doing? Verse 20. "I have against thee this matter, because thou sufferest." In other words, they were tolerating it. The word in the Greek means to let, to permit, not to hinder. They were not hindering the activity of this class of people. I'm not talking about one woman, of course, but a class of people in the meeting. "Thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess or a teacher, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication." Now, of course, he's really talking about spiritual fornication here. The literal Jezebel of ancient times taught and practiced literal fornication. She had 400 boyfriends, didn't she? So she taught by her public demonstration of her ways, literal fornication. He's talking about a class speaking things that have to do with spiritual fornication. "And to eat things sacrificed unto idols," which of course is what happens when your religion's changed. When you go to another religion, if it's not the truth, you're worshipping another god, primarily. So you eat things sacrificed to idols, so to speak. So why was there this judgment impending? Because of apostasy. Now, we mentioned a little earlier that the Thyatiran epoch represented that period in history from AD 606 to 1572 when true witnessing had come to an end in the events of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, you remember. That was in 1572. That's when effective witnessing against the Catholic system came to an end. I mean, the witnesses didn't die until 1685. But their effective witnessing was over in 1572. And the papal system, represented here by the name Jezebel, was ascendant. "Without purity of doctrine, brethren and sisters, there is no salvation." Now, you know these passages as well as I do. In 1 Timothy 4, verses 12 to 16, Paul writes to Timothy. He says, "Now listen, get your head in the Bible, brother. Get your head in the Bible. Give yourself diligently to these things. and focus on doctrine, he says. Focus on doctrine, because in so doing you'll save yourself and them that hear you. That's pretty good advice, isn't it? Now, the reason I'm not taking you there, these passages, one, you know them, and two, I don't have time. Remember? Black Pope at the end. So I don't have time. I've got to crib a bit of time here. Allowing error to be taught results in shipwreck. You know, in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 19 and 20, Paul actually names two brethren that he had disfellowshipped. He delivered them unto Satan because they were teaching false doctrine. Why deliver them to Satan? Well, one, to stop their influence in the ecclesia, and two, hopefully, to convert them, to get them to see that they don't have fellowship anymore, and therefore they've got to change their mind on those things, then they can come back. So, two reasons. Get rid of the leaven, but work to save them at the same time. In Titus 3, verse 1 to 11, and in Galatians 1, verses 8 and 9, we have those very clear passages about how you deal with proven teachers. And I emphasise the word proven teachers of error. You know, the heretic after the second and third admonition. So there's a bit of work involved, isn't there? Quite a bit of work involved. It's not something you do overnight. So after the second and third admonition, you've got to deal with them. You know what Paul says in Galatians 1 about the teachers who were undermining his work in Galatia? He says, if any man come unto you, it doesn't matter whether it's an angel, which of course is an impossibility, doesn't matter who it is, if they teach any other doctrine unto you, any other gospel than what I've taught you, then let them be excommunicated from Christ. That's what he says. They don't belong in the brotherhood, he says. So that is the principle that he's applying. I put upon you none other burden, he says, but doing what the New Testament says you should do with these errors. Did they do it? Well, probably not, because it was a disaster, that ecclesia, in time. Now, I want to take you back to the Old Testament, brethren and sisters, and show you why he chooses Jezebel here in a letter to the Thyatirans. There were two Babylonian apostasies in the history of Israel and Judah. The one that he's talking about is the one in Samaria. It's the period of Ahab, the son of Omri, who brought into the nation Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians. And, of course, that brought Baal worship, didn't it, into Israel. We're going to see that Baal worship came from Nimrod, Cush and Nimrod. It was Babylonian. So the apostasy in Israel in the north began in Samaria. And, you know, Samaria as a city was only 6 years old when Ahab began to reign. And it wasn't too long after he began to reign that he went and got Jezebel to be his wife. And he brings her from Zidon and installs her in this six-year-old city. And it becomes the heart of Baal worship in Israel, to be cleaned up, of course, in due time by Jehu. But there was a second Babylonian apostasy in the history of God's people, wasn't there? And that was the one built by Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah. He brought everything that he could from Babylon into Judah, which is why it was so deeply corrupted that Josiah, the greatest reformer, you might say, in their history in terms of his activity, no one did as much as he did to try and turn God's people around. He was ineffective. It wasn't going to work. God said to him, Josiah, you're absolutely fabulous, and you're going to be in the kingdom. You've got a heart that trembles at my word. You weep because you see what's going on. I mean, you didn't even have a Bible until you were 26 years of age. And when you got a Bible, you reacted to it like nobody else in history's reacted to it. Best thing I can do for you, brother, is put you to death. And 13 years later, he did. He got him out of the way, because the apostasy that Manasseh introduced was so deep, there was nothing you could do for the bulk of that nation. I mean, Josiah's work saved a few, but it didn't save too many. So that is the second Babylonian apostasy. And we're going to focus on the first. But the interesting thing about this is that in Zechariah chapter 5, verses 9 to 11, we read about these two women, you know, with the ephah, with its lead cover, okay? And they cart this ephah off to the land of Shinar. That's where Nimrod built his tower, isn't it? in the land of Shinar. Are you aware, brethren and sisters, that Shinar is the Hebrew form of the Akkadian name Semiramis? Yeah, it is. The actual way to say Semiramis in the original language is Sumeramat. Well, the Sumer part, when you bring it into Hebrew, is Shinar. So when you read of the land of Shinar, you're reading of the land of Semiramis. Semiramis was the wife of Nimrod. You know what she used to do? Every Ishtar, you know, every time that they wanted to worship Ishtar or Artemis or Diana, as it later became known, at Easter time, she used to invite all the kings over which she and her husband ruled to Babylon. And they would pass through the Ishtar gate at the processional way. And she would hold a great feast and commit fornication with all of those kings over whom she ruled. Just like Jezebel used to do. See? She was the first mother of harlots. You know what Semiramis means? I mean, Shinar in Hebrew evidently means enemy's tooth. You know what Semiramis means in the Akkadian language? The gift of the sea. You know what her symbol was? Well, a woman's head, of course, but she had a dove sitting on her. And the dove had an olive branch in its beak. Because, you see, her name means the gift of the sea. She came out of the ark. She came from the ark, they claimed. So like the dove with its olive branch in its beak. She was God's gift to the world. What does the Catholic Church say it is? God's gift to the world. A woman sitting upon a scarlet-coloured beast on a sea. Yes, she's the gift of the sea. And what she called in Revelation 17, a mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Where does she come from? Semiramis. Who was the woman in Israel who matched all that? Jezebel. Got it? That's why he's talking about Jezebel. We're going to talk a little bit about this. And this is where I'm going to test your mind a little bit. Okay, so you've had a rest. You've been given a rest. That's going to change. I want you to come back to the 1 Kings chapter 16. First Kings 16, of course, is the record of the rise of the Omri dynasty. You know, don't underestimate this man Omri. Israel was going through one of the worst periods of chaos. You might recall how that a man called Zimri, who rose up against his master and slew him, lasted for 1 week. And then because he couldn't rule, he burnt the palace down over his own head. And then two more prominent men in Israel rose up and vied for power. Omri and Tibni. Tibni means a man of straw, and he proved to be a man of straw. Omri came to power after bitter, and I mean bitter. They ripped up the women with child in the process of the rise of the Omrid dynasty. But you see, he was a very powerful man, was Omri. He was the one who purchased the hill upon which the city of Samaria was built. And so he was a promoter. He was a man of ideas. That's very important because, you see, there's a formula in our Bibles. It's the formula of Micah 6, verse 16. And if you haven't got this written alongside of Omri's name in 1 Kings 16, I'd suggest you write it there. Micah 6, verse 16. You know what it says? For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab. So Omri is a statute maker. He puts together statements of faith. He writes catechisms. He puts down plans. He lays down the ideas. And Ahab, his son, implements them. Right? Omri's the thinker. Ahab's the doer. That formula comes from Cush and Nimrod. We'll talk about that later. Comes from Cush and Nimrod. Cush was the father of Nimrod. Cush was the great original prophet of the Babylonian mysteries. He laid down the catechism. Nimrod implemented it. Got the picture? That's why that scriptural formula is there. So here we are in the 1 Kings chapter 16, and we read about Omri gaining the upper hand. It says in verse 23, In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, began Omri to reign over Israel. 12 years and 6 years reigned he in Tirzah. He buys the hill in verse 24 that becomes the platform for the city of Samaria. Look at verse 25. But Omri wrought evil in the eyes of Yahweh and did worse than all that were before him, including Jeroboam the first. So he was worse than the corrupter of Israel's religion, Jeroboam the first. And he had a son who was going to be worse than him. You read on down. Verse 28 says, and Omri slept with his fathers, was buried in Samaria, and Ahab his son reigned in his stead. What was he like? Well, have a look at verse 30. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of Yahweh above all that were before him. You know? So he exceeded his father in evil. And he added to it. Because verse 31 tells us this. And it came to pass as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel. Now her name means chaste, not C-H-A-S-E-D, although she was chaste by 400 boyfriends. Chaste, C-H-A-S-T-E. Chaste means pure. It's the greatest misnomer in the Bible. There was no chastity about this woman. She was corrupt to the core. She taught and seduced God's servants to commit fornication. There was no chastity there. Great misnomer. She was the daughter of Ethbaal. Ethbaal means with or near Baal. She never left Baal. She might have come from Sidon, but she never left Baal. She brought Baal worship into Israel. And he served Baal, it says, and worshipped him. And he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. So it becomes the centre of a Babylonian apostasy. And goes on to say he did more to provoke Yahweh God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. You know what happens in his day? You reckon verse 34 is accidentally put there? No, it's not. Verse 34 says this. In his days did Hiel, the Bethelite. Hiel's name means living of God. He was as dead as a doornail when it came to the things of the truth. In his days did Hiel the Bethelite. Bethelite, yeah. That's where Jeroboam put his apostasy, his golden calf, remember? He was a Bethelite. He built Jericho. Built Jericho? I thought it was condemned and cursed. Yes, it was. In Joshua chapter 6 and verse 26, cursed be the man, said Joshua, that rebuilds this city. You know what's going to happen to him? He's going to lose his firstborn when he lays the foundations. Now, he might have had a dozen sons, I don't know. He's going to lose his firstborn, and every subsequent son that's born to him while he's building this place is going to die while they're building it. And his last son will die when they put the gates up. That's what it says about the man who would rebuild Jericho. Why? Why that curse? Well, Jericho happened to be the centre of Baal worship in Canaan when Israel came into the land. That is why God devoted it to utter destruction. What survived Jericho? Gold and something else. A goodly Babylonish garment. What kind of garment? A priestly garment. Who invented them? I'll tell you who invented them. Semiramis. Her inner priests wore a red garment, like cardinals do. Her outer ring of priests wore black garments, because they had to tend the fires. You know, you used to get charcoal on your clothing. Shows up on red, but it doesn't show up on black. So that goes right back to Cush and Nimrod and Semiramis. See? The goodly Babylonians. That's why God condemned it to utter destruction. Guess what? Baal worship's back in the days of Ahab and Jezebel. So a man gets up and rebuilds Jericho. Got it? Yeah. Baal worship's back. So 1 Kings 16, 23 and onwards tells us a little bit about the Omrid dynasty. Ahab was the implementer of the ideologies of Omri, the builder of Canaanite worship. He takes Israel back to Nimrod. He brings about this Babylonian apostasy. Jezebel becomes his wife and promotes that cause in Israel. You know, in 1 Kings, just a few pages over, 1 Kings 21, we read about her effect upon Ahab. 1 Kings 21, verse 25. This is in the slaughter of Naboth and his sons, you remember. Verse 25 says this, "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of Yahweh, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up." The word stirred there, sooth, means to prick, you know, to use a pin, as it were. "Here, here, go and do this." She was always putting a pin in his backside to get him to go and do something to promote her religion in Israel. It says this, "And he did very abominably in following idols, according to all things as did the Amorites, whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel." Amorites? Yes, they went back to the worship of Canaan under Ahab and Jezebel. They went back to Baal worship. So here it is, the Omri and Ahab era. So what about Jezebel? Mother of harlots, teacher of Baal worship, of spiritual adultery. That's why the Lord picks her up in Revelation 2, 20 to 23. But there's another little thing we need to look at. She had a daughter who ended up in Judah, didn't she? Married to Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, who, of course, killed his own brothers on the advice of Athaliah, his wife, doubtless. Because that was Jezebel's policy, get rid of any competitors. So I want you to come back to come with me to 2 Chronicles 22. I just want to show you how this formula works. 2 Chronicles 22. Don't lose 1 Kings if you can. Although I'm going to be taking you around a couple of places here and there. 2 Chronicles 22. This is on the death of Ahaziah, Athaliah, and Jehoram's son, killed, of course, by Jehu. In 2 Chronicles 22, verse 2, we read this. It says in the AV, 40 and 2 years old. In actual fact, it should read 20 and 2 years old. And many of you will have made that correction. He was 22 years of age when he died. When he began to reign, and he died a year later. He began to reign at age 22. He reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Athaliah, the daughter of Omri. Now, that's not correct, is it? I mean, Omri was his grandfather, wasn't it? So Athaliah was not the daughter of Omri. She was the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. So why does it say Omri? Just read on. Verse 3. "He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counsellor to do wickedly. Wherefore he did evil in the sight of Yahweh like the house of Ahab, for they were his counsellors after the death of his father to his destruction. The statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab." There's your formula. See? That's why the Spirit says that Athaliah is the daughter of Omri. "And you suffer that woman Jezebel to teach, to seduce my servants." See where Christ is coming from? So did God have witnesses against the Omride dynasty? Against Ahab and Jezebel? Yes, he did. He had a religious witness, and his name was Elijah. He was the messenger of the covenant. A religious witness against the apostasy growing in Israel. How long was his ministry? Well, 3.5 years, wasn't it? I want you to come to Revelation chapter 11. Revelation 11. So Elijah appears on the scene in 1 Kings 17, verse 1. He bursts into the palace of Ahab. He blasts him. He says there's going to be a famine. He escapes, of course, to the Jordan, to the brook Kereth, and then up to the land of, the Zidonians. He goes up to within a stone's throw of where Jezebel came from. And he comes back, doesn't he? And the events of Mount Carmel, we all know about that. And then he runs away. His ministry lasted 3.5 years, or 42 months, or 1260 days. Revelation 11, verse 1. And it was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar, and them that worship therein. But the court, which is without the temple, leave out, because that represents the apostasy. Don't measure that. Leave them out, it says. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city they shall tread underfoot for how long? 42 months. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. Now, in fact, there are two different time periods here of exactly the same length in years. When it talks about the 42 months, that's the period of papal ascendancy from 608 and 610 AD until the Pope lost his temporal power in 1868 to 1870. And through all of that time, there was opposition to those who witnessed again. So who did God raise up in the period of the Catholic Church's dominance? Well, he had two witnesses, didn't he? He had a political witness, that is, those who would simply not bow to Rome, regardless of religion. And he had a religious witness. That included our brethren. But anybody who opposed Rome on religious grounds was a religious witness against him. So there were two witnesses. One religious, one political. And they worked effectively for a long time. The period in verse 3, 1,260 days, or 1,260 days, and on the day for a year principle, therefore 1,260 years, is the period from 312 AD when Constantine established the Catholic Church, because the apostate Christians supported him to give him the emperorship. Okay, he established their church and he rewarded them. He rewarded them by saying, you can do what you like with your enemies and I'll support you. 1260 years beyond that just happens to be 1572, when effective witnessing came to an end with the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. So you've got these periods. How long is this? How long is 42 months and 1260 days? Well, just happens to be 3.5 years. So read on with me. Read on. Verse 4. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. Who's the God of the earth? The papacy. Standing as witnesses in opposition to the papacy, the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceeds out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven. Am I reading this correctly? These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy. How long was the famine that Elijah brought when he went into the palace of Ahab? Well, 3.5 years. Yes, this is based on Elijah. These have power to shut heaven for the period of their prophecy, power over waters to bring them to blood, etc., to smite the earth with plagues. So God's witnesses against the Catholic system were two. There was a religious witness represented by Elijah in the days of Ahab and Jezebel. But what about a political witness? Was there a political witness? Yes, there was. His name was Obadiah. He was the right-hand man of Ahab. Remember when they went out to find the remaining grass for the few horses they had left to survive? Who does he take with him? His right-hand man, Obadiah. What was he doing? His name, by the way, means the servant of Yahweh. Oh yeah, he had a prominent job in the nation, and Ahab trusted him, but he shouldn't have, because Obadiah, at the same time, was preserving the prophets of God from the hand of Jezebel. She was going around killing them off, and he preserved 100 of them, and he fed them, and he got them out of the way of Jezebel. And when he meets Elijah, he says, don't you know me? Haven't you heard about me? Elijah said, no, never heard about you. You know, in history, the political witness and the religious witness in opposition to the Catholic Church didn't know they existed. They didn't know each other. Isn't that interesting? So he has God has a political witness who's in the government, who's working against the government on behalf of his servants. You know, all of us are familiar, aren't we, with the events that transpire when Elijah goes to Mount Carmel, when fire is called down from heaven, and how he runs before the chariot, and the rains thunder down from heaven to break the 3.5-year drought. Well, I believe all of that's a pattern for things yet to come, brethren and sisters. The fire from heaven, I believe, is Armageddon. It's called by the Lord Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Now, I know some people don't agree with that. They just need to read Revelation 1, verse 7 very carefully, and they will agree with it. The sign of the Son of Man in heaven is Armageddon. It's a sign to the world, to be sure, but it's really a sign to Israel, to the scattered Jews who will undergo the work of Elijah in the second exodus of Israel. Jezebel is killed a little later on by Jehu, isn't he? Just as Rome will be destroyed 10 years after Armageddon. You know that? Revelation 14 verse 8 is proof of that. Rome is going to be destroyed 10 years after Armageddon. And the Pope in that place is going to go down the gurgler. Won't stop them. They'll resort to Central Europe and elect another one and go on for the next 30 years in opposition to Christ. So, the death of Jezebel, I believe, is talking about the demise of Rome. Then the house of Ahab is annihilated by the work of Jehu. Takes him a while, doesn't it, to get rid of all of them. That's a reference, I believe, to the destruction of Babylon the Great, destroyed in what's called the hour of judgment. As Brother Thomas points out quite correctly, that's a period of 30 years. Now, I know that some of these things I could stop and we can... I don't have time. Sorry. We'll do that later. Most of you are aware of it. The hour of judgment is 30 years from the destruction of Rome until the final abolition of the Catholic system, the House of Esau, as it's called in the prophecy of Obadiah. And then finally, the remnant are cleaned up. Revelation 19 and verse 20 talks about the remnant. You know, when the false prophet is destroyed and the beast, that is the revived Holy Roman Empire, when they're destroyed, there's a remnant to be cleaned up. It will take at least 3 years on the current numbers. That, I believe, is when Jehu gathered all remaining Baal worshippers in Israel into one place, didn't he? And he said, you make sure there's no worshippers of Yahweh in there, because Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, demanded that. And all the people in that place wore garments. What did they bring out for them? Goodly Babylonish garments. And they set 80 men at the doors and says, anybody escapes, you lose your head. It's exactly what Christ and the saints will do. They will destroy the remnant of those who have supported the papacy against his rulership post-Armageddon. Now, even in this, we can go back to Elijah. In Revelation 16, we have reference to the destruction of Babylon the Great. So come along to Revelation 16. Revelation 16, we read in verse 17, and the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, it is done. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great political earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And the great city was divided into three parts. I wonder why three parts. And the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. I believe there are three parts for this reason, brethren and sisters, because you see, back in verse 13, we read that the three unclean spirits come out of three mouths. The mouth of the dragon, the mouth of the beast, and the mouth of the false prophet, and that infers the order of their destruction. So who's the dragon? The dragon is the eastern leg of the image. It's a reference to Russian power installed in Constantinople. And of course, when they come down from there into the land, they're destroyed. That's the first power to be destroyed. The beast refers to the European nations, the reformed Holy Roman Empire. That's what they're doing right now. Subdued over a period of 40 years after Armageddon. That's what comes second. So who's last? The false prophet, the papacy, the last enemy to be destroyed before the kingdom can be fully established. All of that comes from Elijah, you know that? All of it. We're going to see in a moment. This is the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ for 40 years after Armageddon. Armageddon, of course, will be a heavy blow to the papacy. This red line follows their trajectory. Oh, a heavy blow won't stop them. Psalm 2, to which I'm going to take you in a moment because it's quoted in the letter to Thyatira. All right? I'm going to take you there. Psalm 2 says that the nations will collect together under the leadership of the papacy, and they will implement their doctrine of the Antichrist and say, that guy there in Jerusalem, he's the Antichrist. They will set themselves against my king. Yet have I set my... It's past tense. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. He that sits in the heavens will laugh them to scorn. So they'll rebuild their power. Rome then goes down the gurgler 10 years after Armageddon. That's a heavy blow, isn't it? Won't stop them. They'll be back into Central Europe, which was where the Holy Roman Empire was based. And they'll rebuild their empire at the very time that Elijah has brought Jury to the shores of Europe, and they have to fight their way through back to the land over a period of 40 years. At that very time, they become the instrument of divine judgment until finally the false prophet is destroyed and then the remnant are cleaned up. Revelation 14 says that Armageddon is the harvest of the earth, that the vintage that follows is the treading out of the winepress of the wrath of God. It's going to take 40 years, the last 30 of it, extremely intense. And then finally, in Revelation 19:20, the false prophet is destroyed. All of that comes from Elijah. Elijah on Mount Horeb. You know this story, don't you? Come back to 1 Kings 19. I did warn you. 1 Kings 19. See, I waited until your lunch was gone because you need a little bit of extra blood flow. 1 Kings 19, the well-known story of Elijah on Mount Horeb. He experiences the passing by of wind, earthquake and fire. Now, what does that represent? Well, have a look what it says in 1 Kings 19, verse 15. I can't go into all the lessons of Elijah on Mount Horeb. That's not the purpose of this. Verse 15. And Yahweh said unto him, go return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. You know where the winds came from into Israel? Well, from the east. From Syria, yes. Hazael. The king of Syria was to be a judge. A judge sent against Israel. Who comes next? Jehu. Says in verse 16, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel. You know, he brought about the greatest earthquake in Israel's history in the times of the kings, didn't he? He completely overturned Ahab's dynasty. A great political earthquake, yes. What came second? Earthquake. So you've got wind, Hazael, earthquake, Jehu. Who comes next? Read the balance of verse 16. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat. Wonder why he's called that. Well, Shaphat happens to mean judgment. What's the symbol in the Bible for judgment? Fire. So we have wind, earthquake and fire. What was Elisha's first work? 42 blasphemous youths, torn to shreds. Yeah. So you see what's happening here, brothers and sisters? But what did he then become? Well, he became the still small voice in Israel, didn't he? The voice of a gentle whisper. And for the next 4 or 5 decades, he held Bible schools and schools of the prophets. Yeah, the voice of a gentle whisper. That's exactly the same pattern that's going to be followed very shortly. Because in Revelation 19 we read that the Lord Jesus Christ goes forth upon a white horse, white righteousness, horse symbol for war, righteous war. And he's going to destroy Babylon the Great. He's not alone. He has others on white horses who follow him. Can I ask you how Jezebel died? Well, she was thrown by eunuchs out of a window. But you know, there was blood on the wall. You know what that means? That when they threw her out, she was grabbing the wall as she went down. So it broke her fall. She wasn't dead. She might have had a broken leg or two. But she wasn't dead. You know what killed Jezebel? Jehu's horses. He rode over the top of her with his horse and chariots. She was killed by horses. And Revelation 19 talks about Christ and the saints going out riding on horses to destroy Jezebel, Babylon the Great. So you see, it's all coming from the past. Great Babylon divided into three parts. Just like Hazael, the eastern wind, came into Israel, so the dragon will be judged. Just like the earthquake of Jehu, so there will be a great earthquake, says Revelation chapter 16 and verse 18. A political earthquake. Just like the fire of Elisha, so there will be judgment upon the papacy. But what will Christ become when all that's over? Well, he will become, to everyone that is left of all the nations, the voice of a gentle whisper. Yes. He shall come down like rain upon the mown grass. Shall speak peace unto the nations. And his dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Everything he says comes out of the Old Testament. And the events, of course, are listed here. The events of the Jubilee period. So when the papacy is destroyed, he's going to call his saints back to keep the marriage supper of the Lamb. Or the marriage is way over here. The marriage is 1 year after we're taken to the judgment seat. That's when that occurs. But the marriage supper has to go back to this period when the papacy's destroyed. You know why? Because the Catholic Church says it's the bride of Christ. That's why. They claim to be the bride of Christ. And Christ is going to wait until he's destroyed them before he shows his bride to the world. That's the story. And this promise is going to be kept. He that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. You know where that's coming from? Have a look at Psalm 2. Psalm 2. That's where that's quoted from. Psalm 2 is the psalm about the period post-Armageddon of the rebellion of the Catholic nations of Europe against the rule of Christ. And this is where the Lord gets these words from that appear in Revelation 2 verses 26 and 27. He says this in verses 8 and 9 of Psalm 2. Ask of me and I shall give thee the heathen, the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Be wise, O kings. Well, they're not going to be wise. You and I have to deal with them. All right. So the reward for those who get up and do something about the Jezebel class is that they're going to be there to destroy her in the end. I will kill her children with death. I don't know what else you'd kill them with, but anyway, I'm going to kill them with death. Their doom is sealed. But too many, far too many, who were in that ecclesia of Thyatira are not going to be there. If you go there today, that's what you see. All right? There's no ecclesia there. So who are you going to deal with? What are the prospects of a black pope, you reckon? Well, this gentleman here is called Peter Turkson. Notice his name, Peter. Who was the first pope as far as the Catholics are concerned? Peter. Who was the first pope as far as God was concerned? Nimrod. We're going to see that in a moment. So he could well be the successor, couldn't he, this gentleman, of Nimrod. So they're talking about black pope. Black pope posters appear in Rome. And this is the guy, Turkson, that they're saying could well become the pope. Now, I don't know whether he will or whether he won't. It won't matter to me whether he's elected this time or not. I don't care. You know why I don't care? Because I'm convinced that one of the popes that Christ is going to deal with at a very vital time, either at Armageddon or in the year 2060, which is when Daniel 7, the papacy does come to its end, and even Sir Isaac Newton knew that, 2060 is the last year of papal rule in the earth. It's 47 years away. Okay? At one point, either at Armageddon or in 2060, we're going to have a black pope. I'm going to give you the reasons for it, the rationale. We will have the complete fulfillment of Revelation 16:14, which says, these three unclean spirits that came from the French Revolution, liberty, equality and fraternity, would do a marvellous work. They're spirits of demons doing signs, which go forth unto the kings of the whole habitable to gather them together to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Yes, those spirits will bring about Armageddon. That's what he's saying. Until recently, the election of a black US president was an impossibility. Liberty, equality and fraternity have changed all that, haven't they? Today, everybody, well, nearly everybody, you've got some rednecks in America who don't accept it, but nearly everybody accepts, oh, well, you know, par for the course nowadays, isn't it? Couldn't have happened even 20 years ago. Couldn't have happened. The election of a black pope would bring the work of the three unclean spirits to its full maturity. I wonder whether there will be a black pope at Armageddon. Wouldn't that be nice? Nimrod, we know, founded the kingdom of men. Genesis 10 verse 10 tells us that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Babylon. At Armageddon, Christ will begin the 40-year process of destroying the kingdom of men. That's when it begins. Doesn't end until 40 years later. It would be fitting, but either then, or as I said, in 2060, the pope of the time was black in skin colour, matching Nimrod, the first pope. Revelation 11:15 talks about that day, doesn't it? Then the seventh angel blew his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdom, it's not kingdoms, the kingdom, because it's one kingdom, the kingdom of men, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. That's why I've got the RSV up there, it's correct. So what about the possibility of this black pope? The rationale. This is the only known visage of Nimrod. Now, this is a term that's not used nowadays because it's seen as a very negative term, Negroid. Negro, colour, black skin, that's what it means. Okay? The only known visage of Nimrod is this man. Happens to have the appearance of a dark man. All right? And Nimrod was a descendant of Ham. And Ham, we know from the prophecy of Noah, was the father of the dark races. Don't ask me about all the way that that happened. I don't know. But he was the father of the dark races. And they were made servants of servants by the prophecy of Noah. That's why they've been in the position they've been in all that time. Okay? Nimrod just happened to be the 13th generation from Adam, and 13 is the biblical number for rebellion. He was the first God king. He was the man who usurped divine authority. He built walls around four cities. He built two sets of mega cities. You know, when it says that Jonah went to Nineveh, it was a city of 3 days' journey. Doesn't mean that you took 3 days to get through the actual city of Nineveh itself. It meant it took you 3 days to walk from Nineveh to the other side of this four-square mega-city. All right? He built a wall around it. What for? To keep animals out, the wild animals that had risen against them, as God said they would. Okay? And so the people said, well, he protects us from the wild beasts. That used to be the job of Yahweh, the God of heaven. Well, Nimrod has replaced him, hasn't he? He's usurped the divine authority over the wild beasts. He can subdue them. They worshipped him as a god and as a king. That's what the pope is, a god king. Nimrod's name just happens to mean the rebel. We will rebel. And the phrase Nimrod ben Cush, which I hasten to add is not strictly drawn from the Hebrew text, It does say in Genesis 10 verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod. Well, Nimrod, Ben, the son of Cush, just happens to have a numerical value of 666. Probably not accidental. Cush was the father of Nimrod, and history records that Cush was also known as Kish and Bel. We get Baal from Bel. He settled first in Babylon, it said. He was the great original prophet of the Babylonian mysteries. He wrote the Catholic Catechism. Bel means the confounder. His symbol was a club, because you see, the result of his work was the dispersion of all peoples, the dividing of their languages. So you find Bel referred to in passages like Isaiah 46:1, Jeremiah 50 verse 2 and 51:44. Those two chapters of Jeremiah contain the name Babylon 55 times, and they are the roots of Revelation 17 and 18. You want to have a look at it? All of Revelation 17, 18 language comes out of Jeremiah 50, 51. That mentions Bel. Bel was later called Baal and Janus. Cush began the form of false religion that spread throughout Mesopotamia and Canaan. The principle here, of course, is the one we saw in Micah 6:16. For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab. The statutes of Cush are kept today, and all the works of the house of Nimrod. Read Catholicism. So where do they get this title pontiff from? They're in the process of electing a new pontiff right now, aren't they? Pontiff actually means a bridge. You know, you've heard of a pontoon? Where do they get the word from? Pontoon's a bridge between God and man. Pontiff, they call him. So the Pope is acknowledged as the Pontifex Maximus of the Roman Church. It was the title of pagan Roman emperors who were official high priests of the pagan mysteries. The title can be traced right back to Nimrod. He was the first Pontifex Maximus. The supreme pontiff of paganism bore the Chaldean title Peter. Yeah. He bore the title Peter, the Pope's. The first Pope, according to the Catholic Church, of course. The interpreter of the mysteries. The office of Pontifex Maximus, or chief priest, was to declare and interpret the divine law and preside over sacred rites. So who's this Janus? You know, Cush became known and Nimrod became known as Janus eventually. Well, Janus was the god of doors and gateways. You know, we have janitors. You ever heard of a janitor? Yeah, he's the guy that cleans up the mess when you drop your Coca-Cola or something in a government building. The god of doors and gateways. That's where January comes from. January is the month. I was born in January, I'm sorry. But anyway, January is the opening month, isn't it? It's the doorway to the new year. That's how you get this. The temple doors of the temple of Janus faced east and west for the beginning and the ending of the day. Between stood his statue with two faces gazing in opposite direction, one toward the east and one toward the west. One face was young and the other was old. Why? Well, because Nimrod, who died at age 40, was replaced in due time through fornication by Zoroaster, or Tammuz, to use the biblical name. Tammuz. His symbols were a key and a rooster, a cock. Okay? See the key in Janus's hand? Cardinals is from the Latin cardo, which happens to mean hinges. It's derived from the priests of Janus, the gods, the god of doors and hinges. You know why? Well, because Semiramis, the mother of harlots, had an inner circle of priests, and their mark was a red gown. Okay? And they were the ones who controlled the door to Semiramis. And the cardinals are sitting down in a conclave to elect the successor to Benedict the 16th. I wonder whether their election will produce a black pope. We'll have to wait and see. I want to conclude with a picture. Can anyone tell me which direction the front of the Vatican faces? Anyone know? Don't look at the picture, they won't help you. It faces east. Someone here, you're ingenious. You know, what you've done is you've looked down here. See? East, that way. So that's east. I know this because I was there in 2005 at 11 a.m. in the morning. And I'd spent some time in the Vatican that day. In fact, I went right to the top. See up here? Right to the top, where you look out over this dome, this white dome. You know that dome's got little vents on it. Hundreds of them. Well, dozens of them. Every one is a memorial to a pope. You know how it begins? P.M. Leo. P.M. Paul. P.M. Gregory. You know what P.M. stands for? Pontifex Maximus. That's who they're electing in the conclave. The successor to Nimrod. He was a black man. Alright? So the Vatican faces east. It's actually a temple of Janus. Did you know that? Because I think you've already noticed this fact. This is the forecourt. That is in the shape of a key. And the key was the symbol of the god Janus. And when you walk into that place, they want you to know that they hold the keys of the kingdom of heaven, see? When I was up on this top here, I looked over the garden. This is the Vatican grounds in here. I looked over the back. It was summertime. There was a flower garden there. Guess what the pattern was of the flowers in the garden? Two keys. They're reminding you of what they think this place is. It's the perfect place, isn't it, for Nimrod's successor. Maybe his last successor. We'll just have to wait and see.